Thanks. I'm gonna talk about planetesimals. If you're not interested in the subject matter, you can hopefully enjoy the background slides here. This is sort of courtesy of Artemowitz Airlines. On our flight, we actually didn't get to see any whales in migration. It was more of a continuum dynamics, I guess. We did get to see Santa Cruz Island, which was quite nice. Here we are. We're making a theory of planet formation at this workshop and conference. On the top here, I've indicated that, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, what maybe Chas would call the ancillary science that goes into sort of setting the initial conditions. Then on the bottom here, you sort of have what sort of maybe 80% or 90% of the talks at the conference are about. Sort of somewhere in between these two, a miracle has to happen, and we don't yet understand completely how that.
Can you find the miracle in your paper?
You can find many miracles, yes. Not as many as you produce, Doug. It's clear that, you know, lots of people are thinking about this, including, you know, Yoram sort of mentioned this possibility of sort of continual planetesimal destruction and formation. There's lots of interesting things that are going on. Dust is in the title. You start with dust grains, which you actually know that in dense regions of molecular clouds and protostellar disks, dust can coagulate and grow to larger sizes. The simplest thing you might hope is that, well, this coagulation can just proceed all the way up to kilometer sizes. Once you get to a kilometer, which you've noticed everyone using as their typical planetesimal size, you're sort of home free. You have a nice surface gravity. You're good and decoupled from the gas. The problem is that the reasons dust grains stick is because they have a very large surface area to volume ratio, and they can stick by van der Waals forces. It's kind of like if you take your sort of pastry tray and turn it upside down, it's only the small crumbs that will stay stuck to the plate.
Can you experiment?
Would you like to eat the pastry first? The problem is that in, you know, as you get beyond, you know, a certain size, let's say a millimeter to be specific, those van der Waals forces are no longer significant, and you no longer have any binding energy that's at all significant to the kinetic energy at which these rocks are flying around. Just to remind you that the typical speeds that things can move around at, even in a laminar disk, things can get up to 50 meters a second just from their coupling to the gas. There's another problem that if you wanna proceed through coagulation, which sort of gradually takes you through every size range, you will have to pass through sort of a difficult regime where your radial drift speeds are alarmingly fast, and you risk being lost into the star in 100 years. To be generous, I'd say the best idea that I've heard of how to make coagulation work is the idea that, well, you're not sticking rocks together, but you're sticking together things that are, you know, kind of like the lunar regolith, and they have this, you know, this nice loose structure, and you sort of fire something at it, and it can just sort of embed itself in this target. Hopefully, there's not a very big splash created that causes you to lose more than you gained. That's sort of a difficult thing to analyze. There's a recent experiment that's done. Some people say no science gets done on the space shuttle, but here's something where people, you know, did this. They sort of threw sort of centimeter-sized projectiles into some loose regolith. It seems like they found that, you know, around 10 centimeters a second, you started creating, you know, significant cratering. Of course, 10 centimeters per second is pretty slow compared to the speeds that things are flying around at. This is a nice experiment. You could argue about exactly how to interpret it. I'm a little worried by the last sentence of the abstract because it says, you know, taken together with a proposed aerodynamic planetesimal growth mechanism, these results support planetesimal growth at impact speeds above the observed threshold. of 20 centimeters per second. And so this is the kind of thing that concerns me, that there's experimental results which, on the face of it, seem discouraging, but then people still say that, well, this supports the idea of collisional growth. And we can maybe argue in the discussion time about this aerodynamic growth mechanism. It's basically the idea that if you generate a bunch of debris and cratering, that somehow that reassembles back on to the object it was torn off of. So, okay, then the other idea is that you can have some collective instability that takes you directly from these small, say, millimeter-sized things up to a kilometer in size. And this is actually not easy either. The problem here is that if you have turbulence in your gas disk, the turbulence is very effective at coupling to these sort of small particles and keeping them sort of lofted above the midplane. And of course, you need to get down to the midplane and have a high enough particle density for reasonably fast gravitational instabilities. And so you can do sort of very crude twiddle arguments to show how big a problem this is, and sort of show that with a balance between sort of turbulent viscous stirring and settling at the terminal velocity, that the sort of ratio of scale heights of your particle and gas disk are sort of given by the square root of this ratio of the sort of standard alpha fudge factor for your turbulent viscosity, and this sort of this important parameter that's your rotational frequency times the stopping time of a particle. And the point is that for small things, say if you're a millimeter-sized sphere at an AU, this parameter is about 10 to the minus 3. And so that means to settle to a point where you have sort of equal densities of solids and gas, you have to have some sort of alarmingly low alpha value. And so there's some ways around that. You could say, well, perhaps the mixing is not isotropic, or perhaps just the disk is very laminar at some point in time. So one question you might ask is, well, how dense do you actually have to have this dust layer to get gravitational instability? You might naively assume, well, that it's just the Roche criterion, but of course, there have been sort of several works over the years that have shown that this is actually not the criterion, that because you have sort of strong coupling to the gas, I mean, that does a lot of things to the system. For one, it actually makes the growth slower than dynamical. You normally assume gravitational instability equals... Whoa. Yeah. That was dynamical. So the gas does a bunch of things. So for one, it sort of slows down the instability, basically because these particles have to push their way through all this gas that they're tightly coupled to. But also because this damping is very effective, it actually allows you to get instability at densities which are below the nominal Roche density threshold, although of course it becomes even slower because you have to collect material from even larger distances. So, but this is sort of the heart of the matter, I guess. This is sort of the let me sort of briefly summarize the famous argument made by Stu of why sort of turbulence in the midplane is inevitable. You can't just say things are perfectly laminar. And the problem is that as you let particles settle in a laminar disk, you get to the point where the density is, of course, higher in the midplane. And so that means that in the midplane, when it's dominated by particles, you're going to have essentially Keplerian rotation, because that's what particles like to do. But when you're dominated by gas further up, you're going to have more pressure-supported rotation, which is slower by a factor of about 50 meters per second. And so this vertical shear is, of course, a destabilizing influence on the dust layer. Okay, and there's a sort of very useful parameter eta that will sort of crop up from time to time. It's just the ratio of it's essentially a non-dimensional measure of the radial pressure support, so the ratio of sound speed to Keplerian speed squared. There's lots of different ways of sort of treating, you know, what is the effect of this shear instability on the dust profile. I think the sort of what makes the most sense and is the most elegant is the argument by Sakea, which sort of says that, well, for small particles that are well coupled, you're going to settle until you sort of trigger this instability, and then because you're so well coupled that you'll essentially be frozen near that marginally stable state. And because the main thing that's counteracting the destabilizing influence of the shear is just the buoyancy of the mass in this dust layer, the relevant instability is the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, ignoring the fact that there's a rotation for the moment. And so the relevant criterion is that this layer should be described by a Richardson number of a quarter, the critical value. Okay, and so when you actually do that and calculate a dust layer according to that prescription, this is sort of me just using Sakea's prescription, you find that, well, indeed, you get sort of a mid-plane dust density that's, you know, well below the Roche limit. And of course, I already told you that that's not the important criterion, but it's, you know, it's way below, so any gravitational instability would be quite slow. But then an interesting thing happens as you sort of change your boundary conditions and sort of increase the sort of surface density of solids that's contained within this layer. One thing that's interesting is that the height of the layer doesn't really change, essentially doesn't change at all as you do this. But what does happen is mathematically you notice there's the development of a cusp, right, and which eventually becomes singular at this finite value of surface density. And essentially what's happening is that at this point the sort of average density or the average amounts of mass in the layer are equal between the solids and the gas, and this essentially tilts the balance in favor of buoyancy. And the end point is that you, which is somewhat intuitive, that you can these shear instabilities only have so much free energy available, and they can only stir up a certain amount of solids. So again, just the simple picture then is that, you know, you have, you know, the gas scale height, which is very large. Particles that are large enough will sort of settle down. There'll be this sort of weakly turbulent boundary layer near the midplane, but there's only so many things that can fit into that midplane, and whatever can't fit in there goes further down and goes gravitationally unstable. So, okay. Recently, Pascal Gouraud and our fearless leader Doug have conducted a work which verifies one of the fundamental assumptions of what I just said, that this shear instability is in fact described to a reasonably good approximation by the Richardson criterion. And so Pascal and Doug did this in the context of a two-fluid study where you had solids and gas. And they were working in the strong coupling limit that we're interested in. And they essentially just allowed the background state to settle until it became linearly unstable. And this sort of included, you know, lots of physics. They looked at isothermal and adiabatic perturbations. And essentially what they found is that, indeed, instability is triggered when the characteristic Richardson number of the layer is, in fact, somewhere near a quarter. And they also found something that's sort of consistent, although in a different reasons than what we found. That again, if you increase this ratio of surface densities, they sort of have this dark region of their plot, which is this eta parameter versus the surface density ratio and the polytropic index. There's this region up here where the disk is relatively cool, and the density ratio and the disk is sort of augmented by, you know, about an order of magnitude, that they find that gravitational instability of the dust layer will happen before you trigger these shear instabilities. So that was nice to see. Okay, I'm going pretty good here.
Other sources of turbulence, like MRI, does all this go away? Or?
So that's, I mean, that's the key point I said, that if you want to, you know, sort of the naive estimate that I gave was that, well, those other sources of turbulence, their effective vertical mixing would have to be equivalent to an alpha value of, you know, 10 to the minus 6 or so, depending on, you know, particle size and where you are. But yeah, so the other sources of turbulence would have to be comparably weak to this vertical shear. But I think the general principle is that, you know, well, I mean, if you just dump enough solids at it, eventually you're going to get more than can be stirred. So now I want to talk about some sort of work in progress. That's what I've been doing while I was actually at the workshop here. It's this sort of related and very simple problem of, you know, looking again at this sort of rich phenomenon that you get in these two fluid systems, which is something, you know, like with Pascal and Doug, that people are really just starting to look at. And so I just wanted to take a very simple system, actually, you know, not self-gravity or anything, but just look for drag-based instabilities. So where you have sort of two fluids, one that represents your solids of a given size and another representing the gas, and they're sort of coupled by these equal and opposite drag forces. So that in addition to having drag on the particles, you're dragging back on the gas. And this is, you know, so very simple. There's actually no vertical structure in this model. It's just sort of infinite uniform in vertical extent. And now the basic state of this system, the steady state of solutions to this system are well known. Sort of the Nakagawa, Sakai, and Hayashi paper. And it basically involves the sort of radial drift that I was talking about before. I'll sort of briefly mention why that background state is interesting. If you have particles that are small enough for Epstein's law to apply, you get that actually the sort of drift rate due to the radial inflow of the particles is larger sort of in the outer regions of the disk. So if you start with some initial profile, things are going to sort of pile in from the outside, and your surface density is going to increase, and perhaps it will increase enough that you get to this critical surface density of solids that will saturate the vertical shear instabilities. Okay, but here I'm not interested in that background state. That's the state I'm sort of expanding about, this mean flow. And I'm looking whether there's actually something not global, something more local that could happen. And so the quantities that are perturbed are these, the velocities of both fluids. I'm assuming that any instability is, of course, going to be sort of slow and secular. So I'm assuming that the gas is incompressible. And also, since modes are slow, I assume that the modes are axisymmetric, because anything that's non-axisymmetric would get sheared away on a dynamical time scale. It's a simple, well-defined problem, because you have two fluid equations. You get sort of six eigenvalues with, in general, a growth rate and a frequency. And the solutions are they're relatively simply described in terms of four dimensionless parameters. You have this stopping time parameter, which has to be less than one for this whole scheme to be valid. You have mu, the sort of equilibrium ratios of your solid to gas densities. And then you have your sort of two wave numbers, the sort of radial and vertical wave numbers. And you can non-dimensionalize them according to this length scale, this pressure length scale. And interestingly, when you do that, this sort of eta parameter actually scales completely out of the problem. So I'll show you some figures in a second, but just to briefly summarize, what you find is that of these six modes, three are sort of very strongly damped on a stopping time. Two essentially correspond to epicycles, and those can be either growing or damped. The ones that grow are perhaps not that interesting, because they have a fairly large kz, so you would not be concentrating material over the entire extent of the disk, but just in these relatively thin layers. But the last mode actually is interesting, and I think worthy of further study. So first, just to sort of show you what happens, this is sort of taking a given value of this stopping time parameter and just looking at a whole bunch. I think there's maybe 400 modes here as a function of this density ratio. And you see that, well, indeed, there are modes that, you know, appear to grow on, you know, in this case, something like 1,000-year timescales. I think the main thing to sort of point out is that it looks like these modes are not going to be effective at concentrating mass on relatively large scales, because these sort of long radial wavelength modes, which are in red here, are do exhibit relatively weak growth. And you know, you can of course twiddle all these parameters around. When you go to the main point here is when you go to more marginal coupling, stopping time of only 0.1, sort of the scale changes here, and by an order of magnitude, and so the growth is faster in this case, because the particles can sort of more easily sort of slip through this gas. So here's another way of looking at what's going on. These are contours of the growth rate for sort of given values of the stopping time and the density ratio. And sort of one thing that crops up here is there's this sort of strip, which I do not understand exactly why it's there, that sort of describes that says the fastest growing modes sort of lie along this curve. When the vertical and radial wave numbers are related in this way, and that seems to be a fairly universal thing for a bunch of different parameters. What? Mu. Sorry. Yeah. The background density ratio of solids to gas. So, yeah. So these are cases where there's, you know, there are sort of less solids than gas. So back here I was sort of showing the growth rate sort of as a function of mu. So that little curve seems to work pretty well. Let's look at just sort of take one specific mode here to see what it's doing and see how I'm trying to understand it. So this is a mode with sort of kz equals 1, so it has a vertical extent comparable to what I might expect the dust layer thickness to be. And the sort of radial wave number is relatively large, as I said it sort of needed to be. Here's the sort of just what you get from the numerical solution. And sort of there's this interesting feature, which is kind of bizarre, that sort of when the sort of density ratios of the two components are completely equal, it seems that, you know, growth is suppressed. It's almost as if one component has to be able to push the other one around, and if not, then the response is much weaker. You can try and do, you know, sort of expansions to get sort of analytic expressions for these growth rates, and if you just sort of naively do an expansion in stopping time, you get something that sort of works kind of well in this region, but sort of doesn't do as well in other areas. But then if you use the fact that there's this apparent relationship that kz is in fact a sort of small parameter compared to kx, then you actually get sort of a simpler cubic equation, and you see that one actually does a very good job of describing the modes, you know, except in this mu equals 1 region, where the simpler system says that the growth rate actually goes all the way to 0. So, okay, and this is just sort of a picture of what that same mode is actually doing when you and sort of these are sort of the in-plane velocity vectors, and sort of as you see, because it's sort of strongly coupled to the gas motions, which are incompressible, you have a larger component of vertical velocity, and then you have sort of contours of the particle density that's getting concentrated. And sort of the important thing is that the particle concentration is sort of comparable in this dimensionless scale to the velocity perturbations. You sort of expect them to become nonlinear about the same time, and says that this sort of is perhaps relevant as a way of concentrating particle density. So do I really understand this? Well, it's still a bit early for me to say. One of the things I try to do is to sort of simplify the system even further to see if you can get a little bit more at the heart of what's going on. But it turns out that anything you take out gets rid of all the unstable modes you take out. It's actually easy to show analytically that when you get rid of the Coriolis forces, that sort of forces the solids to be incompressible. As the gas is, so you definitely need the rotation in there. You obviously need the drag, and the motions also have to be 3D, as you saw. If you got rid of the vertical velocities, that was essentially what was going on. This incompressibility of the gas is a sort of strong constraint. The solids are just sort of slowly leaking relative to that, and so as the coupling becomes sort of somewhat weaker, that kind of aids this growth, So to do more to understand whether this is whether this is something that's actually relevant, you'd obviously want to include a model that had more vertical structure and stratification, and also including some turbulent viscosity that might obviously have an effect on the very small scale modes and stabilize some of those. That was sort of meant to just paint a little portrayal of some of the rich possibilities that exist in sort of two fluid physics, and we can head into sort of a discussion. And sort of main point I want to make is I think the Goldreich board mechanism is viable. There are constraints on it that you do have to have a disk that's fairly passive, and that there has to be some mechanism of concentrating the solids even when self-gravity is weak. But of course these conditions don't need to be satisfied everywhere all the time. They just need to be satisfied at any given position long enough for you to make the planetesimals, maybe 1,000 or 10,000 years. And so we can perhaps discuss this, in order to get this enrichment, there's lots of possibilities. There's the possibility that Frank and Eugene and I worked on, that it's if you just wait for aerodynamic drift, that does it. There's various secular instabilities, including the ones that I talked about here and the ones that Jeremy Goodman has worked on. And then of course it's a two-way street. You can also just wait for the gas to go away, and as long as that doesn't take the solids with them too. And as long as you still have enough gas to make Jupiter, that works fine. And then there's other possibilities, including solids getting dumped back into your disk by an X-wind, or as they fall out of the X-wind. There's been lots of interesting work here on vortices as well, though it's not clear how effective vortices are at concentrating small particles, even if they exist. Joe Barranco has some very interesting work where he's sort of shown that actually vortices do a better job surviving at about a scale height above the midplane and not in the midplane itself. There's some other advantages to this model, as if you do invoke this radial drift to sort of trigger planetesimal formation, might explain why planetesimal formation seems to have this edge to it at about 43 AU or so, and that planetesimal disk does not extend out to hundreds of AU. I'll leave it to others to mention the benefits of the collisional hypothesis, and perhaps we can discuss together sort of what's needed to sort of come to some sort of consensus on this. I think sort of studying two fluid phenomenon is a key thing to do. And of course, another big problem is that planetesimal formation is not something that can be observed directly. And so it's good to work on problems that where you can, you know, make a comparison to perhaps similar systems that do have observational constraints.
Okay, here we go for questions and discussions. We'll start.
Okay, I'll get the first crack at you. Yeah. No, we'll be civil about this. Now, I'm perfectly willing to admit that gravitational instability is mathematically possible. It's certainly mathematically possible given the right conditions. The real question is, you know, whether those conditions are physically plausible as compared with the conditions that are required for collisional growth. As I understand your model, you do require a nebula which has an extremely low degree of turbulence, like alpha of 10 to the minus 7 or so, plus, in addition to that, an enhancement of the surface density of solids with respect to gas, either by enhancing the solids by bringing them in by this drift mechanism, or else getting rid of the gas, and after a certain point you will be able to meet the conditions for the gravitational instability. I do think that discussions of the collisional growth of planetesimals tend to be overly simplistic. The argument that collisions are at a speed of 50 meters per second, for instance, and that all the collisions are going to be therefore erosive are sort of neglecting the fact that we have in any realistic system a range of sizes of particles. You have a range of collisions going on at different velocities, and also if you do settle particles into a moderately dense layer, you're not going to have this 50 meter per second impact velocity, because within the layer, once it reaches a reasonable density of solids with respect to gas, then the solids drag the gas along with it, and the particle layer becomes more nearly Keplerian, and that decreases the relative velocities of particles that are impacting. Now, I do numerical simulations where I consider the size distribution of particles as they develop and coagulate. I don't simply assume coagulation, but put in what I hope are realistic collisional properties, including the possibilities of erosion as well as coagulation. And yes, it's certainly possible to have conditions in which you cannot get collisional coagulation. But I do find that if you have net accretion at impact velocities below 10 meters per second, which is consistent with some impact experiments, then you can get growth even in these, even when you do account for the possibility of erosional collisions. Now, in order for this increased density in the central plane and decreasing the collisional velocities, you do need a pretty low turbulent nebula. If you have an alpha that's greater than about 10 to the minus 4, then you can stir up the particle layer to the extent that it no longer becomes dense enough to drag the gas along with it at such a rate, and then the impact velocities go up, and that may stall collisional growth. So it may be necessary for collisional growth that the turbulence decreases, so alpha is less than about 10 to the minus 4, but that's still about three orders of magnitude better than you seem to need for gravitational instability. So I think there's still certainly possibilities to be explored in the regime of collisional coagulation as well.
Okay. Yeah, that's a lot of points that are all good. See if I can go sort of through them, at least maybe starting from the end, the sort of comparison of alpha values. I mean, it's a good point that, you know, people are sort of well aware that turbulence is a problem for gravitational instability, but perhaps less aware that it's also a constraint on collisions. I mean, the number I gave sort of was, you know, a specific value for a given particle size at a given position in the nebula. As you know, if you go further out, then even those millimeter-sized solids will become much more marginally coupled. And as you go into that marginal coupling regime, then the settling becomes much easier. So, it wouldn't be a problem to fudge things and get a number that's 10 to the minus 4 further out. Let's see. So the relative speeds. I will stand by that. Sort of 50 meters per second is a good characteristic speed to use, especially because once you sort of go over the hump of the fastest drifting particles that are moving in, then you have not just the relative radial velocities, but also the relative azimuthal speeds, which between the big things and the small things is the full 50 meters a second.
Well, once you've gone over that hump, then most collisions are between things which are bigger than that hump, and actually at that point they are driven more by the difference in radial velocities, since the transverse velocities all tend asymptotically to a single value. The question then is,
you're still going to have small things hitting the big things.
Yes, you do.
And those are erosive.
In most of the discussions of this, people make the extreme assumption of either only considering the small things hitting the big things or considering particles of the same size. And I'm saying you have to consider the entire size distribution, which is in my numerical models. And I think for plausible numbers, you can get collisional coagulation.
Yeah. Well, so again, as you said, the number you use is of order sort of tens of meters per second for this sort of critical threshold.
Meters per second,
yeah.
We'll do it.
So, and as I said, the zero gravity experiments seem to show that it's 10 centimeters per second where you get this significant cratering.
I think you're over-interpreting that very limited experimental data there.
Yeah. Well, but the experimental data that you used is based on sort of creating experiments that were done in Earth's gravity, and I would say that's sort of equally invalid.
I think those experiments were not really gravity limited. The size of the crater and the mass of the ejecta. You were actually in the strength regime, I think, in those cases. We can discuss that offline later if you want. But clearly there's a need for better experimental data, including zero gravity data. Yeah, there's always a need for more data everywhere you go, which means we need more money, of course.
Yeah, and obviously the space shuttle is not going to be doing these experiments again anytime soon.
Well, there are some experiments, like various experiments, various groups are trying to do, especially in a variety of environments where there are marginal salvation points.
These are difficult experiments to do, but it's probably easier to do it first with the more volatile material than the refraction material. But nevertheless, I think just from one or two experiment, I agree with Stu that it's not adequate to draw some conclusions.
So one of the points I'd like to make on these experiments is that the results of any experiment are dependent on a lot of things, but in particular on particle size. So I mean, the experiments are done for very practical reasons on relatively small things. So you had these sort of centimeter, millimeter projectiles. Of course, the sort of splash that's caused by a meter-sized boulder is going to be much bigger than the sort of cratering that's caused by a little pellet. And that that sort of extrapolation is something that needs to be taken into account if you're going to sort of extrapolate sort of micron and centimeter sizes all the way to a kilometer.
I'm trying to get a handle on good initial distributions for simulations of growth from planetesimals. And let's say you're in a regime where things are quiescent, things settle down, gravitational instabilities happen. Then you talked about times of 1,000 or 10,000 years. Now, is that for the gravitational instability to start, or for once it starts to produce planetesimals? In other words, well,
yeah.
Why don't you answer that and I'll follow.
Okay. So planetesimal formation is dominated or is heavily influenced by gas coupling, right? And gas coupling is very dependent on particle size. So to say how long something takes depends very much on what size particles you're talking about. So but to give you, you know, a simple answer, that because the instabilities that I've studied, that are these gravitational instabilities with drag, the time scale for the growth of the instability is essentially the same as the time scale for vertical settling, because essentially to have a gravitational instability, you have to have self-gravity comparably strong to the mean gravitational field. So whatever the settling time is of the dominant constituent of small particles, that time to settle and the time for the gravitational instability should be comparable.
So you'll get the gravitational instability in a large region over the same time, as opposed to the little area of the cusp becoming unstable, producing some planetesimals with a small fraction of the solids in the disk, and then more having to settle, or... you just say, right, that the finger of gold right descended on the disk and suddenly there were planetesimals?
you could say that, but of course it's much more complicated than that.
But planetesimals are going to start doing some stirring too once you form the first ones, and is that going to prevent the rest of the material from forming into planetesimals?
How many do you think you need? I mean, as long as you get a few started, then they start sweeping up everything.
Well, I mean, that's the question. Is there a planetesimal disk, or do you get a few planetesimals and then they sweep up everything?
I think it's probably in between.
Obviously it's, you know,
the entire disk doesn't become, you consume the entire disk, into planetesimals before you start combining them, because the first form planetesimals now will start cannibalizing everything else. So, you know, you need very few to actually form.
Yeah. Want to respond to that, or otherwise there is no question there.
If, for instance, you made a few planetesimals and put them in a layer of dust and still had the gas present, it would be difficult for those planetesimals to accrete that rest of that dust. When you get to a size of about 100 meters or so, then there is enough of a flow around the planetesimals moving through the gas that fine dust, which is coupled to the gas, will actually be swept around rather than accreted. In fact, that also cuts down on your erosive collisions at this 50 meters per second number that you like that much. You do have to get things up to like 100 meters or so in size for that to happen, but once that happens, then really fine dust is not going to accrete onto planetesimals as long as the gas is still there. They'll only be able to accrete things which are big enough to be decoupled from the gas.
Well, I mean, maybe you only get 1%. I mean, what does that, you know? There's still enormous accretion rates compared to what the other material is doing, even if it's very inefficient.
I think some of the stuff I did show. I mean, obviously, you know, if you say things are perfectly coupled, then yes, you can't get the dust out of the gas. Of course, things are not perfectly coupled, and even, you know, even a slow drift can have, you know, can have important consequences.
Can I ask about your non-gravitational instability? If there is dust mixed in with the gas, the entire gas disk, could that lead to turbulence in the entire gas disk on longer timescales?
So I obviously can't show from this simple study what's the eventual, you know, nonlinear outcome of these instabilities. There's perturbations not just in density but in velocity, and you know, whether that flow would be sort of this large scale flow that it is, and, you know, sort of, you know, whether it's this flow on the scale of the particle disk, or whether that will break into turbulence, it's, you know, it's not something you can say. particle. I mean, they are. I mean, I have the sort of two fluid. They are, like, interpenetrating. Well, that's sort of what I assumed. I assumed that it's uniform and infinite in extent. And that's obviously not realistic, but, yeah.
Would it really drive the disk turbine?
If the dust is only a small fraction of the mass of the disk, then one would expect even if it went gravitationally unstable, it wouldn't stir the rest of the disk.
Yeah, so I'm not trying to make the whole disk go gravitationally unstable, right? I'm just trying to assemble
I'm just commenting on Yorm's.
Oh, Yorm, yeah. So again, and yeah, so even in this case, we're talking about not what's going on in the whole disk, but what's going on in the midplane layer that the dust has settled to. So, I mean, I mean, there seems to be this range where obviously if the ratio of solids to gas gets too low, obviously this instability, you know, falls off. I mean, you can't, you can just sort of take the limit where the dust is just a test particle, then obviously there's no instability there. There has to be this sort of feedback between the two. The part I don't understand is why this feedback doesn't work when the two components are sort of precisely equal. That's the part I find bizarre.
But this isn't gravitational.
No, not at all. Yeah. Just clearly. Yeah. This is purely dry.
So you mentioned that the vortex might enhance metallicity, so to concentrate dust, maybe. But isn't the much more interesting and more important effect of a vortex that does not have any vertical shear? So doesn't then become the gravitational instability you're talking about much more realistic than outside a vortex? No, there isn't any more vertical shear in a vortex.
Well,
it cannot be. Yeah, but the vortex is going Keplerian anyway. The right ones are going Keplerian.
Yeah, so I guess you're referring to sort of some equivalent of the Taylor-Proudhon theorem that would keep things rotating independently of height. I mean, yeah, so there's obviously a lot more work that needs to be done on sort of what's the realistic 3D structure of vortices. I mean, Joe seems to find that, you know, things get destroyed by vertical stratification, and other people seem to say that, you know, you can get vortices in the midplane.
And if you simply assume that there is no vertical shear, then I think everything goes smoothly in your model.
Well, sure. I mean, if there's nothing to stir the particles, then there's, I think, you know, even...
Well, there are still maybe other sources
like,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Hello? Just a short question. If you want to enhance the amount of solids relative to gas, you said that one way is to wait until gas is starting to go, and that enhances that ratio. But isn't that much too late?
Well, that's debatable, right? I mean, how much gas do you have to have? You have to have essentially one Jupiter mass of gas, and that's just sort of, you know, 10% of this minimum mass nebula that I guess Stu is disavowing. So it's clear that, you know, the gas that went along with all the rocks in the solar system, you know, left at some point. And it's just not clear sort of when, whether it left prior to or after planetesimal formation.
Can you say anything about like a Jeans mass with this model, the sort of Jeans mass of the instability?
So if you take the case where the density is sort of the Roche density, then the characteristic wavelength. You know, even though the growth rates are very different from the one fluid case, the characteristic wavelength of the instability is actually the same. So that means that you, the sort of estimates of Goldreich and Ward that you get, you know, that you get a kilometer-sized planetesimal from a standard surface density disk, that still appears to be the case. There is, I should say, an added uncertainty that because the growth is slow and it occurs as axisymmetric rings, you actually get the sort of radial collapse before the azimuthal collapse. And so it's not clear, and I don't understand yet exactly, you know, whether the radial and azimuthal wavelengths are going to be the same. That's an assumption that goes into getting this kilometer size.
The Corradini and Al look at that.
The breakup of the rings.
Okay, so it's 12 o'clock, it's lunch time, so let's close here in the morning. So afternoon session.